Hello, and welcome to this summer edition of Movie Time. I'm Julie Rigg. Glad you could join me. Summer's always a great time to take in a movie. It's also a good time to relax with the radio. So this week, we're bringing you an in-depth conversation with Ben Zeitlin, director of one of the more remarkable films released this past year. Beasts of the Southern Wild is set in a rough-and-ready community called the Bathtub, deep in the Louisiana Bayou, outside the levee that holds back the rising waters of the Big River. And the story is told through the eyes of a remarkable six-year-old girl called Hush Puppy. She's played by Kvenzane Wallace. Her father, Wink, is trying to teach her how to survive on her own. Her mother has disappeared, we know not where, and in this rough-hewn community built from scraps and salvage, everyone is aware that they're living on borrowed time and living very close to nature, and that the climate is changing. One day, the storm will come and the river will rise. Beasts is an extraordinary film with an extraordinary performance from young Kvenzane Wallace, now tipped for an Oscar nomination. And here's some of the conversation I recorded with Ben Zeitlin back at the Melbourne International Film Festival in August. Zeitlin, by the way, is a musician, an animator, as well as a director. This is his first feature-length film. It's had a remarkable trajectory. But Zeitlin's parents are both folklorists. What did that background give him?
You know, they're very, they have this weird business. It's like a nonprofit initiative in New York City that's about documenting culture, basically. And, you know, they wrote books. When I was a kid, they were actually writing books about children's games. So, you know, they would just never tell us what to do. They would just sort of send me and my sister out into the alleyway, and then they'd be kind of looking out the window and writing things down that we were making up. And, you know, I think more than anything, they're extremely open and they're kind of blown away by weird people, not necessarily artists or anything, just some guy on the street corner who is trying to sell a t-shirt to you. And they, you know, my dad will like fall in love with the way this guy is trying to sell him the t-shirt, and then he'll follow him around all the time and try to write down what he's doing. And when I would never think about this consciously, but, you know, when I look at the film, you know, the process that we go through, it's almost a collecting process that creates the film. It's about finding people, finding stories, finding, you know, collecting the way people talk, the way people build something, or and almost assembling all that culture into the story. So I think that kind of the early stages of just being inspired by, you know, culture and people is probably something that comes from my folks.
But you went to university in Connecticut, Wesleyan University. Sounds very WASP.
Yeah.
And you came together as a group to make films. Tell me about some of the collaborators that came together as Court 13.
Yeah, I mean, it started as this weird, you know, we were making this animated film, Egg, and I met this guy, Ray Tintori, who is one of the other directors in the group, because, you know, I basically wrote this story that was about this tiny microscopic pirate that was trapped inside of an egg trying to hunt the yolk. and I couldn't figure out how to make it with live action, so I was like, I better learn how to animate if I'm going to tell
the
story.
It's called Egg, and it's on the net, by the way.
Yeah, you can find it. But I went to Prague to learn how to animate from the kind of the staff that was working on the Spankmeyer films.
And so you met Jan Spankmeyer.
Briefly, but mostly I was working with his lackeys, who are brilliant, and one of whom shot Beasts of the Southern Wild. But it sort of started there. It was these whole group of guys that were animating for Spankmeyer, and they'd moved into this apartment complex, and they had studios in half the rooms, and everybody was sleeping underneath their sets and stuff. And then we sort of took that idea and brought it back to the school and took over this abandoned squash court. And, you know, I was working in this place 24 hours a day trying to make this animated film, and people would come in and animate with me or just show up and hang out while I was working. And it just became a kind of thing where everybody was doing their own art, and we were incorporating that into the film, and just kind of grew into the collective. You know, you sort of pick up people every time you do a movie. Somebody gets hooked on this method and then becomes part of the family and then returns for the next one.
Well, I think filmmaking is a collective endeavor. And it can be a collective with more hierarchies or fewer hierarchies. We might come back to that. But Court 13, this was an actual squash court.
Yeah, it was an address.
How did you
actually
wind up on a squash court?
I got evicted from my house. So we found this squash court and just moved. It was abandoned, and it was on the second floor, and no one ever went there. And so we moved into there as a way to kind of continue making the film. One great thing was there was an administrator had like a driving range secretly in one of these squash courts also, and the fact that we knew that he was there, you know, when he was supposed to be working actually helped us out.
Now, before we get to Beasts, there's a glorious 23-minute short film called Glory at Sea, which was a kind of precursor to Beasts of the Southern Wild. It's on the net also. It is beautiful. You'll see some of the themes and some of the images that haunt us from both these films. Now, I gather this, it begins with a man, a very hairy man, staggering out of the water. And I read that you imagined him first on a Greek island. What is this, Ben? Greek mythology? Poseidon emerging from the depths?
Orpheus.
Right. Okay.
You know, there was a whole trajectory to the film, but it started as this kind of, just loving kind of the Orpheus myth. And it started with this idea of, you know, this shipwreck where, you know, there were a couple people left alive on top of the water, and then everybody else had gone down to the bottom of the water. And this choice that you have of whether, you know, it's better to survive on a stick floating in the water or go down to your people who are all dead at the bottom. And so that was this kind of fable that I'd written that I was trying to make, and then that fable basically got, through a series of misadventures, landed in New Orleans, and then this kind of idea about being above and below the water took on this whole other resonance. I basically, you know, I wanted to make the film. I had $7,000, and so once I made $7,000, I quit my job and went off trying to make this five-minute film, and then I got to New Orleans, and this whole thing happened where all these people started getting involved and all these stories started getting incorporated, and people would bring us things to put on this boat that was part of the movie that were humongous, and then we had to figure out how to make the boat bigger and the story bigger. And so this five-minute film became a 25-minute film, and it went from $7,000 to $100,000, and it just was this completely reckless, tumbling boulder going down a mountain that was the film.
Did it feel in control or out of control?
No, completely out of control. I mean, it was it was the most irresponsible thing I've ever done in my life. It was totally wild.
Tell me about New Orleans when you arrived, because it was post-Katrina. Mm-hmm. And you'd been thinking hell, and you'd been thinking loss and grief and finding your loved ones again through this myth. But I imagine it must have been a shock to the senses to arrive.
Yeah, it was extremely eerie. The main sensation is that it was incredibly empty. There was nobody around, and you're never in a city where there's no one there, you know. And so it feels like the Wild West, you know, of the kind of ghost town. And it was very lawless, and just was a very spooky, very sad, and very kind of dangerous feeling place at that time, and you know, and it's not anymore. It's really transformed since then.
Why did you go there?
I had a lot of friends there, and because I'd been there in 2004, you know, about a year before the storm, and had made all these friends, and I'd also been there as a kid with my sister, and we had always kind of dreamed of moving to New Orleans at some point. And then when the storm happened, I was in Europe, kind of flailing and failing to make this film, Glory at Sea, and and I just sort of put together the myth with what happened. You know, I was thinking about this idea, and then this storm happened, and it felt like, wow, this story somehow speaks to this event. You know, so I was talking to my friends down there, and they said, you got to come here. It's really important to be here right now. We have a couch. Move on to it. And, you know, I wasn't really expecting to stay. I'd been to, like, eight different cities trying to make the film, but then when I got there, it was totally clear.
I mean, one of the things that Beasts of the Southern Wild gave me is such a contrast to the terrible images from Hurricane Katrina of people herded into a stadium as shelter, frightened, they were being assaulted, they were short of food and water, they were in terrible grief and anxiety about their loved ones. And I somehow saw a kind of triumph over these experiences feeding into the mix that became Beasts of the Southern Wild. Was that what was working in your imagination as you talked to the people both in New Orleans, the deserted city, and in the wider bayou?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I love the most about the city, you know, even when I first got there, there is so much laughter in that city every day, all the time, every night. And it got close, but the city just refuses to be kind of crushed by loss. You know, it's not just Katrina, you know, it goes back to Camille and Audrey and Betsy. It's happened so many times, and even just hurricanes aside, you know, the murder rate there, there's a constant loss going on and there's a constant grief. But, you know, it's like the way that a funeral happens in New Orleans. I don't know if you know the tradition of jazz funerals, but
we do.
Like that impulse to kind of transform grief into joy and celebration and hope, and it has such a inspiring reaction to that. I think both films weren't necessarily, I mean, I don't think Glory Tea was about that before I got there. That was something that I sort of noticed immediately when I got there, that people were just as sad and hurt as they were, and kind of as many as, you know, these sort of broken winged creatures, they were still gonna get up and not be kind of ground into misery that was permanent. So that was, it's a really inspiring element of the culture that I wanted to celebrate.
There are a lot of big themes in Beasts of the Southern Wild, and when I saw the film, I knew nothing about you, nothing about the background to the film, but we'd experienced huge floods and other extreme events here in Australia. It's a worldwide phenomena. And it just struck me how beautifully you made a film that helped people search for a whole set of meanings out of these experiences. The theme of survival in Beast, it's very noticeable, the community called the Bathtub. They're living beyond the levee, and in essence beyond the arm of the law and the state, relying on themselves and on community. What's the inspiration for that community?
The actual place. You know, there's one section in New Orleans, it's called the Batcher, where it's this row of houses that used to be on the right side of the levee, and then they moved it to the other side of these houses. It's about 15 houses, and it's this really insular... you know, they just refuse to leave those homes, and they just build them higher and higher, and it's very defiant. You know, they could easily move the houses right over to the other side, but they're not. It's their land, and they're not going anywhere. You know, so that, and also, you know, the communities down the bayou. There's an island called Île de Jean Charles, which is sort of not the cultural inspiration for the film, but the inspiration for kind of the issues that are going on, and you know, that's really. You look on the map, you look into the marsh, and you drive all the way to the end of the road, and then you get to the levee, and then you go over the levee, and you drive another 3 miles, and you get to this place that that used to be this thriving, self-sufficient community that was just, you know, had a lot of the same qualities as far as, you know, it was French-speaking, so it was totally cut off culturally, you know, it was, you know, living on fish and agriculture and on livestock, and so it was totally self-sufficient. They had their own education, and that's been kind of shattered by these environmental disasters over the last 50 years or so. And so, but what's left is this sense of community and people helping each other out and, you know, getting together and finding ways to continue to celebrate and thrive in, you know, internally in spite of the sort of external disaster.
You're with Movie Time on RN. Julie Rigg with you, and we're listening to a conversation with Ben Zeitlin, creator of the remarkable film Beasts of the Southern Wild. This conversation recorded back in August at the Melbourne International Film Festival. We learn a lot about people of the bayou and their interdependence with the river, with the swamps, with the creatures in Beasts of the Southern Wild. To little Hush Puppy, they're a sense of wonder, whether they're beasts that are tended by the community or beasts that are caught. Tell me a little bit more about the bayou and this kind of relationship with the ecology as it was and how it's changing.
Yeah. I mean, it still is there. It's amazing. There's a real pride in being able to cook anything down there, and not just sort of be able to eat anything, but actually to make anything delicious. And I've had animals that you cannot believe how good they are, and they know how to clean them and cook them. And it's
for example,
like raccoon is delicious. Nutria, which is like a giant swamp rat, isn't delicious, but it can be pretty good. I think there's a different kind of feeling when you go to other places and you kind of feel bubbled off and kind of sheltered from nature, and almost like it's not going to affect your life. But down there, it's so, you know, your nose is full of flies. You're getting bitten by mosquitoes everywhere. You know, you sink into the ground. And
sounds a lot like here.
Yeah, I don't know. Australia. It's just, you can't ignore the fact that you're an animal when you go down the bayou. You know, it's so clear that you're just one of many creatures surviving in this weird precipice between the water and the land. And, you know, there's a real sense, too, that that's a big part of the inspiration for the movie. You know, I think that when you sense so clearly that all your commodities can be taken away from you so quickly, there's a further appreciation for things that transcend your house and your car and your bank account and your, you know, whatever else. You know, there's a real pride, and I think it's absolutely true that down there you can take all those things away from people and they're still going to survive, you know, and there's a real pride in that, and there's a real pride in being able to pass that down to the next generation of not relying on anything other than yourself and the environment that will be there no matter what.
How badly, though, is it threatened by the kind of climate change and pollution and degradation we're living through?
Yeah, terribly. I mean, it's coming from so many different directions. I mean, we used to have barrier islands in the Gulf that would, you know, these storm systems that come out of the Gulf would hit the barrier islands, and then they would get a little bit weaker before they got to the land. And those barrier islands have been cut up by pipelines that run back and forth to run oil from the Gulf, and they've been eaten up by saltwater, so they don't exist. And so this town now is the barrier island, so they get the full force of the storm when it comes. On top of that, it's the closest town to where the Deepwater Horizon spill happened, which that rig blew up on day one of our shoot, and the oil was actually coming at us as we shot. The town is completely reliant on seafood for their economy. They've had the two worst seasons they've ever had the last couple of years. And almost every other place, when you get to the end of the road, the civilization drops off, you know, 100 miles before you get to the coast. And this place has refused to leave. But there's a real sense that, you know, if you can't fish there, that place will be gone, and it will happen within 5 years.
Animation. I've been disappointed often in recent years by what CGI is doing to animation. But in Beasts of the Southern Wild, there are monsters, but they're real, and they're from a long time ago. I don't want to spoil the film for the audience, the radio audience, who hasn't seen it, but we have to say there are aurochs in this film. They are real prehistoric animals. Tell me what started you thinking about them.
Well, they were in the play. They were like a big part of the play.
The play was
called Juicy and Delicious, which was adapted into the film. So they took a total transformation. You know, in the play, there were basically three guys in red tutus who would Total Eclipse of the Heart would start playing, and then they would come in and like do a dance on stage. And so, like everything else, we were translating. But you know, they were an important figure because they were Hush Puppy's sense of the apocalypse coming. And you know, to me, it was a very accurate sort of, you know, you have these things that haunt you when you're that age that are very real. You know, there's a monster under your bed, it's there. And so, you know, it comes from the cave paintings at Lascaux. And I thought something, it's a lesson that Hush Puppy learns from her teacher about these cavemen, and that she connects herself to, because it's this moment or these characters that sort of are on the verge of extinction and that are sort of the last of their kind.
Mm. But they're beautiful. How did you make them? You didn't use CGI.
No, yeah. I'm sure we wouldn't have even if we could have, but that was never on the table. Basically, I went to Rayton Torrey, who is another director. I sort of gave him control over this unit and told him, you know, we have to use real animals. we figured out that we could train infant piglets to wear costumes, basically. And so we raised them. We got them when they were about 2 weeks old. And the training was done entirely with popcorn. They love popcorn just as much as movie
food
audiences.
Training and animals.
Yeah.
The holy trinity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we learned what they could do, basically. You know, we could basically get them to stop, kneel down, turn around, and eat and run. And we taught them to run on treadmills, actually, which was a feat. Really cute.
Animals were hurt.
No, the pigs went to actual farms where they will never be consumed. And they
never have to run on treadmills again.
No, they retired.
Unless they get another casting call.
We built miniature sets around them and used a lot of light tricks and, you know, stuff that I took from animation of how to kind of disguise, scale, you know, and so about 85% of the effects are all in camera. We shot it on film in super slow motion. And then, you know, the final sequences are we shot the pigs on green screens and then just composited them into regular live action footage.
Well, they are truly beautiful and at times truly terrifying.
So. Great actors as well.
Yeah, pigs are very smart.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to stop now and invite questions from or comments from the audience.
Thanks for a really inspiring film. Saw it last night. And one of the things that really struck me, I was three rows back because we arrived a little bit late, and your use of handheld and close-ups I noticed a lot, and I just wanted to ask you about your stylistic choices as far as the photography of the film.
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to really get inside of her head, you know? That was the main intention, you know, and it had a few different principles behind it. You know, shooting at 4 foot height, you know, was really important, and we needed to, you know, we use this thing called an easy rig where you can kind of hang the camera down at that height at all times and still be able to walk it. That was a key thing. Shooting on really long lenses was really important, you know, for a couple reasons to kind of get that sort of childlike, you know, when you're a kid, you're not looking at the big picture ever. You're sort of very focused on details, or that was my experience anyway. And so we wanted her focus to always be very, very specific and very thin. And so you can't see the whole world. And so we shot with very long lenses and very open exposures to get that really shallow focus and also to keep the camera away from the actor, which was a really important thing. You know, we wanted these close-ups, but we didn't want the camera to be something that they saw, and we wanted them to be able to operate without feeling that. And so,
was there an inspiration for the cinematography?
Yeah, there's a bunch. One of them was this film that, you know, some people made who are not here right now, but this film called Jerry Can. That's a short that I saw. Australian short that I saw and loved. And that had that same quality to it. You know, the camera, I could tell, was always really far away from the actors, and it had these great child performances. But and I think the third thing that was really important was I directed the cameraman like he was an actor. You know, I told him, this is depending on where we were formally, whether, you know, sometimes you're in Hush Puppy's subjectivity, you know, in which case she's in control of where the camera goes and why it moves at what it's moving at. And so you have to think like her and sort of explore the way that she does. And so you're in her mind, or at other times when you're in a more objective, formal moment, it was really important that he behave like he was in the moment with the actors and he didn't know what was going to happen. And so, you know, it's like if you have a shot of this glass and someone's going to pick up this glass, you know, if he panned to the glass before the hand went to the glass, we would cut and say, you know, Ben, like you're not in the moment. You don't know they're going to reach for that. So wait, you know, you have to wait until the hand goes and then you have to follow it the way that you would be making a documentary. And so, you know, and I would tell him his motivation, like how he's feeling as a cameraman. Like if you're, you know, if something is going to explode in the room and you're making a documentary, you react to that. You know, you wouldn't stay still. You'd be freaked out.
It actually leads on to another of my questions about how you direct actors underwater. But you were doing it through the cinematographer, through the cameraman. Or were you underwater too?
No. I wasn't underwater. I would have been. But
they wouldn't let you?
No, they said you have to watch the monitor. So we had a feed coming onto the shore, and you know, and you can only act underwater for about 5 seconds. And so, you know, you give direction and then, you know, you say go underwater and act and you get 5 seconds of acting and then they come back up and you know.
It must have been very grueling for your actors.
It was way easier. It was so hot out that actually the underwater stuff was probably easier than anything because we were like in the swimming pool all day. So,
yeah. Okay. I've got you. Next question.
Hi, I'm one of the unlucky people here who is yet to see your film because it was so popular it was sold out.
Sorry.
I was drawn to the film by the description that included the issue of global warming. Mm-hmm. So I was interested to know how important that was as an issue or a character or whatever in the film, and how did you translate your concerns about that issue into the film?
It's interesting, you know, the film is very apolitical in some ways, kind of intentionally, which partly just comes from me wanting it to be that way, but it was also an interesting collaboration going down to this region, which is extremely conservative, actually, politically. You know, it's a red state. And not only that, but a lot of our collaborators, you know, work on the rigs and they work in the oil industry. And so it was actually really important for me to address the emotional aspects of global warming without addressing like the political aspects of global warming. And so the way it plays in the film is really, it's little things that Hush Puppy knows about, this little girl, and she's interpreting them in a very childlike way that she doesn't completely understand the issues. And, you know, hopefully what it boils down to is just a more emotional response to it. Because I think you can look across political lines and say that if these endangered cultures on the fringes of the world go underwater and disappear, that that's a universal tragedy. Like, whatever you think about SUVs and Priuses, you know, we can all agree that losing your home is a tragedy for the world. And so that's where I tried to put the film, just trying to think about what it's like to lose a place, you know, and it gets less into the political elements, which I'm also very interested in, but which I just didn't feel like had a place in the movie necessarily.
But it does have this theme of courage, ingenuity, and collectivity as means of surviving.
Yeah, it's about survival, for sure.
Which I think, I mean, I had to use the word redemption because every second American movie comes with, you know, some built-in cliche at the end about redemption. So we're not going there in either the religious or the pop culture sense, but it is the hopeful and inspiring thing, I think, to me, of this film. I want to thank everyone for your contributions, and if you'd like to check out Ben's shorts, including Egg, The Origins of Electricity, and above all, Glory at Sea, you can find them online. Just go to Court 13's website. Please join me in thanking Ben and look forward to glories to come.
Thanks.
Filmmaker Ben Zeitlin. Beasts of the Southern Wild was in cinemas here a few months ago, and it will be released on DVD. Do watch out for it. For up-to-date reviews of new films in our cinemas over summer, do check out the film reviews on Radio National's Summer Breakfast with John Doyle. I'm Julie Rigg. Catch you then.